Welcome to our third and final sermon in our sermon series entitled Christ Church, A Five-Year Plan. Today's sermon title, Play to Win. Open your Bible to 1 Corinthians 9, verses 24 through 27, and let's begin.
Usain Bolt is probably, arguably, one of the most gifted athletes of all times, and he's definitely what they are calling the world's fastest man. If you've ever had a chance to watch him race, he does the sprints. He is crazy fast. He is an Olympic athlete, a world champion, and he runs the 100 meter, the 200 meter, and the 4x100 meter relay. And he currently holds the world record in all three of these races. Listen to how fast he runs. In the 100 meter, he runs it in 9.58 seconds. Like, I can't get out of my chair in less than 10 seconds, and he's run 100 meters. The 200 meters, he did in 19.19 seconds, and in the relay, it's 36.84. He literally, he has the three fastest times that have ever been run in the 100 meter, and at the 2008 Olympics, he set a new world record in the 100 meter and in the 200 meter. Now, what's insane about him is he is the only runner in the history, recorded history of ever, the Olympic Games, to win three gold medals in three sprinting events in at least three consecutive Olympic Games. So literally the last three Olympic Games, he ran three races and got gold medals in all of them, holding nine gold medals. And he just gets faster. It's crazy. Like, one of the things he ran, he got so far ahead. Number one, he set the world record. His shoe was untied. And he actually, like, slowed himself at the end to, like, look behind and see how far ahead he was. And he still beat everybody and set a new record. He's started running in championships at about 14 in Jamaica, and he started competing seriously at the age of 16. So for a little bit more than half of his life, he has been training to be an Olympic-level athlete in sprinting. And if you look into how, like, sprinters train and the work that goes into how they condition themselves, it's crazy town. Like, the amount of work that goes into it, they work on things like tempo and speed and endurance and strength. And most elite athletes spend about 20 hours a week just on conditioning and training for, remember, a race that lasts seconds. Seconds when they actually run. So they work in the weight room, they train in the track, they run at different variations and different speeds and different directions, they do circuit training, leg conditioning, upper body conditioning, and of course their diet is very, very regimented and regulated what they eat. So athletes will train for years and years and years before they compete, before they're ready to compete at this world level. And interestingly enough, they usually train with the very people that they compete against. They train in teams. They train side by side. And so all of this goes into preparing them for this race, for this big moment when every runner puts his feet on the blocks. They go up to that line and they shoot out of the race as hard and as fast as they can with the goal of winning. Everybody who's on that line has the expectation that they might win, and they're going to run as hard as is possible to get there. And Usain Bolt just keeps blowing them away. Like, just keeps blowing them out of the water. Now, what is incredible about it is Olympic athletes hold such a special kind of honor, right? Like, these aren't the guys or women getting these NBA contracts where they make millions and bajillions of dollars. The ones who do well, they do get sponsors and they make money, but they do it for the recognition, the honor that comes from being an Olympic athlete. They do it for the, you know, the absolute bragging rights to say they trained at this level and they won. But you don't just walk onto an Olympic field and compete. You don't just wander your way into happening to get a gold medal. Like, can you imagine if I just, like, showed up one day and tried to run? I'd look ridiculous, one. And there's no, like, I have no hope of possibly winning. It takes an entire life of training to become an Olympic athlete. And if you go back, I mean, the Olympics have been going on for thousands of years. And what they originally won was a wreath. They would make these wreaths out of olive branches. They'd put it was like a garland you wore on your head. And that was the huge honor of winning. I mean, they've upped their game a little bit. Now you get like gold medals and silver medals and bronze medals. But this idea of running for the honor that came with it, for the recognition of being the best of the best, that's always been imbued into the Olympics. And what's interesting enough is this idea of running a race, this idea of winning the race that you're running, the Apostle Paul was incredibly familiar with it. Look at what he says in his letter to the church in Corinth. He says in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, starting at verse 24, "Do you not know that in a race all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I don't run aimlessly. I don't box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and I keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified." So Paul makes two really big points that he wants us to see in these verses. He's familiar with these Olympics. He's familiar with these races. And he says, guys, you've been to the stadium. You've seen these races. You've seen these athletes performing before. And when you see these runners running in a competition, all of them run, but only one person wins. You've been at the stadium. You've cheered for them. You've been a part of these games. But only one person wins. Runners spend all of this time and this energy and this focus and this attention and this training to become their best so they can win a prize. They exercise self-control in their life so they can be their very best at the sport that they say matters. And they do it for that wreath that eventually dries up and withers away. But Paul says the same thing is true for life. In life, everybody's running this race of life, but not everybody is running in the way that they'll win. And Paul says, when you think about your life this way, when you're running the race of life, you got to figure out how to run in the kind of way that you can win, that you do life in the kind of way that sets you up for success. Says you got to figure out how to exert self-control and live in the kind of way that you can win. And so what he wants us to see here is this is a contrast. There are two different ways to how we approach life. So one way is you just kind of coast your way through. You just kind of waste your time through day after day after day. You never really expend a ton of energy. You kind of just go through the motions, just survive work till you get to go home and relax and kick back. And you don't get overly concerned with very much. You clock in your hours. You count down the hours till the end of the day. There's the approach to life that just really never exerts anything about yourself. You just never really do much. You never try anything new or never try anything hard, or you've never pushed yourself or challenged yourself in a very, very, very long time, if ever. Haven't learned anything new lately. That's one way to approach life. We've seen people live that way, or we've recognized we've lived that way at times of our lives. Just getting as comfortable as is possible and staying there. Just getting through the rest of everything, surviving with as little pain and as little discomfort as possible. But Paul says that's the exact opposite of how we're supposed to be approaching life. So that is the exact opposite way of what it means to run in the kind of way that you win. Because we weren't created for lives of mediocrity. We weren't created to just settle somewhere, dig in, and just entrench ourselves until the end of time. That's not why we were created. That's not the purpose of our life. Said we're running this race, but we're supposed to be running in the kind of way that we figure out how to win. We figure out how to do life in the kind of way that pushes us and challenges us and calls out different things in us, helps us push away against the status quo instead of just floating, instead of just coasting through. Paul's saying we got to be intentional about the way we do life. We got to start thinking about the choices we make, because the choices we make now, the lives we're living today, these are the things that set us up for the futures that we're creating. He says, We got to give all that we can to live this life that God's given us, not just surviving until the end, but figuring out ways that we can thrive and grow in the process. But that doesn't happen by accident. You don't just drift your way into your very best life. You got to exert some self-control. You got to exert some self-control in how you do life, which means you got to require something of yourself. It means you think about the choices that you make every single day. And instead of just choosing what's easiest in the moment, thinking about how do these choices right now help me accomplish the life that I want to live. It means we have to say no to certain things. It means we've got to deny ourselves in certain things so we can say yes to the right things. And that doesn't come intuitively. It doesn't come naturally to us. We want to say yes to the things that feel comfortable and the things that are easy, and we don't want to say yes to the things that are hard and the things that are challenging. But self-control means I've determined the kind of person that I want to be. I've said this is the purpose for my life, and now I can make the right decisions that help me get where we're going. And Paul's like, look, we see athletes do this. They train themselves. They exert self-control so they can win a prize, so they can win a race. They do all of this work and all of this energy and all of this effort for something that falls apart, for something that doesn't even last their lifetime, let alone any of the lifetimes to come. But Paul says, we're doing this. We're figuring out if athletes can train themselves to win a prize, to win a race, to make their bodies conditioned for that. Couldn't we figure out how to do that with life? Couldn't we figure out how to train ourselves to do life better? Couldn't we figure out how to train ourselves to live out the life that God's given us the capacity to live? Because the honor is greater. The honor for a life well lived goes beyond one lifetime, and it trickles down into the generations to come. And Paul says that's the goal. That's what we're striving to. We can't ever be effective until we've figured out how to exert control over our own lives. We can't ever be effective at doing good and leading at life and leading in others until we figured out, how do I make myself be the person I said I would be? How do I make myself do the things that I said I would do? How do I live out this commitment to be the person that I've said I would be? So that's the first part of it. And then Paul's second point is, let's talk about how you do it. Let's put some pieces to it. If you want to exert self-control, if you want to attack life differently, if you want to determine to do life differently, how do we do it? How do we arrange our lives to make that possible? Look what he says in verse 26. It says, I don't run aimlessly. I don't box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. He's like, you know, we aren't running without a goal. There's no just out free. There's a determining factor of where we're going. We have a destination. We've determined the life we want to live. We've determined the purpose for who we want to be. We've said, this is the life that I want to do, and we're running full force into that. But we have to remember, who's the ultimate judge of a life well lived? Like, who's going to be the one that weighs and measures and says, you did it, you lived up, you got it, you're great, well done, good job? Christ. Christ is the one that determines, did we run this race well? Did we take the life he's given us, the gift that he's given us, the opportunity, the chances, all of these wonderful things, and did we do our very best? Because as we thought about last week, Christ is the one that we stand before, and one day, for good or for bad, he's the one that we get to answer to. But it requires self-discipline to live on purpose. It requires starting with saying, I am in control of me. I'm not a victim to life. I am in charge of myself. And there are circumstances that are beyond my control and things that have happened that I can't change and parts of my history. But look, I'm nobody's victim. I am a fighter at life. And this is an approach to how do we do life. And once we get control of that, we say, now how do I discipline myself to live that out every single day? Holding ourselves accountable, being committed to the things we said we would do, not making excuses or giving ourselves an out or not saying it's okay to not try or listening to that stupid voice inside of our head that says the most mean things in the entire world. Do you have that voice? Nobody has said meaner things to me than I've said to myself. And people have said mean things. They've tried. But my own self, this stupid voice that I have, this tape recording that goes over and over and reminds me of the stupid things that I've done or the times that I embarrassed myself that I just wish. Do you have those, like, out of nowhere you remember the most embarrassing, stupid moments of your life? And you're like, why can't I forget this? I have forgotten so many other things. Yet I can remember one time in eighth grade when I made an absolute fool of myself and people laughed at me. And all right, we have these inside of ourselves, and we get inside of our own head, and we make excuses, and we excuse away behavior that we never should, and we reason our way out of things that say are important, or we listen when we tell ourselves that we're not good enough, or we listen when we hear that voice that says you're not smart enough, or all those not enoughs because there's like 100 bajillion, we listen, and we knock ourselves out of the game because we hear this voice, and it's louder than the voice we should be listening to, because the voice of Christ should be overwhelming that other voice, because the voice of Christ says, you matter, you have value, because I say you do. Because the voice of Christ in me should be greater than the doubts and the insecurities and everything else that comes our way. Paul says, I'm not disciplining myself. I'm not swinging at empty threats. And you know, if you actually listen to the way that the Greek translate it, he literally says, I'm punching my own self in the face. Like that's what, like to be punched under the eye. Like I'm not boxing at air. I'm boxing myself because I'm doing the work that it takes to get my life under control. I'm not living aimlessly. I'm saying I'm physically doing the work to discipline myself so that my body, my life, my spirit, my heart, my mind are in submission to the life I say matters, to the life I've been called to live. Because that voice doesn't get to win. Because that nagging sense of insecurity and doubt, they don't get to have the final say. Instead, we get to see ourselves as children of God. We get to bear the image of an awesome God because he created us in his image. He did. Which means imbued inside every single one of us is the image of an awesome, wonderful, good God. And that gives us strength and courage and value that we don't let ourselves off the hook. Paul says, no more excuses, no more quitting, no more giving up, no more throwing in the towel. It's time to do the work. It's time to put the effort in, the training in, so that we can live our very best life. And it sounds so good, doesn't it? Like, it sounds right. But the problem is, let's be honest, training isn't easy. It isn't. If it was, we'd all be Olympic athletes, right? We'd all be like rocking the Speedo shorts and the six-pack stomachs because it's easy and it doesn't, but it's hard and it requires effort. I love, Muhammad Ali said, I hated every minute of training. I hated it. But I said, don't quit. Suffer now and live the rest of your life as a champion. Athletes have determined that they're living their life, they're suffering now, so they can have the honor as being a champion in their craft, in their sport, and in their field. It's not easy, but it's worth it. Now imagine if we took that same mentality and applied it to life. I'm willing to suffer to train myself to be a better person now for the honor that comes of Christ looking out to me and saying, well done, good and faithful servant. You don't get to be a champion without the work. You just don't. You don't stumble into living your best life without exerting the energy to control yourself and discipline yourself for the tasks ahead. So how do we get more self-discipline? Because again, if it came naturally, all of these things we said mattered, we do easily, but we got to work at it. So I'm going to give you five ideas that I got from this article I read in Forbes magazine. It's five methods that we can use to gain more self-discipline. If you're writing it down, it's a really good five things to think about. In this article, it said, according to a 2013 study, people with high self-control are happier than those without. The good news is that self-discipline is a learned behavior. We can learn the behavior of being more disciplined. It requires practice and it requires repetition, but every one of us is capable of learning the discipline to live out what we want to live. All right. Said these five things, they help, what they do is help you establish good habits, break the bad ones, improve your control by making simple changes to your everyday routine. So here's number one. To develop more discipline, you have to remove temptations. Out of sight, out of mind, right? If I'm saying I want to eat healthier when my house is filled with junk food, I don't want to eat the healthy food, I want to eat the junk food, right? It's there and it looks amazing. So the first thing I have to do is remove the temptations and the distractions from my environment. And this spills into every area. You know, eating is one example, but if you're trying to work on focus, you got to do something with your phone so you don't get distracted, right? You got to limit the time or limit the notifications that get off. You set yourself up for success by ditching the bad influences, which starts with saying, what influences in my life are having bad influence on me? What voices do I hear? What people am I around? What things am I putting into my life, whether I'm watching it or connecting with it, that are temptations that lead me away from the very best life that I want to live? And once I've identified them, then I got to do the work to say, okay, these things help set me up for success. When I'm around them, I'm a better person. These don't. And we start removing the temptations. Number two, listen how interesting this is. Eat regularly and healthy. Studies show that low blood sugar often weakens a person's resolve. When you're hungry, your ability to concentrate suffers as your brain is not functioning to its highest potential. Which makes sense why we all get hangry, right? Don't blame me for what I said. All right. Hunger makes it difficult to focus on the task at hand, and it makes you grumpy and pessimistic. If you aren't filling yourself and fueling yourself with the healthy and right things, you're grouchy and you're pessimistic and you've got a bad attitude and things don't look bright. So you're more likely to have a weakened sense of self-control in all areas of your life, your diet, your exercise, your work, your relationships. So to stay better on track, you have to make sure you're fueling yourself with healthy snacks and meals. Because it actually, when you do, improves your decision-making skills and your concentration. Number three, don't wait for it to feel right. Part of the problem with making good decisions or discipline is it doesn't feel good. And usually our bodies are so trained, something that doesn't feel good, you resist, right? And we think, well, when I'm in the right mood or when I'm in the right frame of mind or when I get to the right place in my life, then I'll make all of those adjustments. You never do. You never get to a place where you're like, you know what, this feels so good, now I should start. Instead, what happens is we push it off. They said, improving self-discipline means changing up your normal routine, which is uncomfortable and awkward. And when a behavior becomes a habit, we stop using our decision-making skills and we just go on autopilot. We're so used to it, it's so rote in what we do that we just autopilot respond. So breaking a bad habit and building new ones requires us to make decisions and it feels wrong. It doesn't feel good. Your brain resists it. Have you ever tried quitting something before? Like whether it's smoking or pop or a certain food or it doesn't feel right. It feels wrong. And you're like, you know what? Why did I make this? This is the worst decision of my life. 3 days in and I'm regretting making this decision. But what happens is your brain wants to do what it's been programmed to do. You've built these normal pathways, and when you resist them, it doesn't feel good. But what you have to say is, I'm embracing that it feels wrong. I'm embracing that it doesn't feel good until the time and the habits become different and you build into yourself these changes. If you wait for it to feel that way, it'll never happen. All right. Number four, schedule breaks and treats and rewards for yourself. This one I like. This one sounds way better. So whenever you try to self-discipline, it doesn't mean this like regimen that is like entirely like cold turkey or hardcore or drill sergeant-like. But when you're practicing self-control, schedule breaks for yourself. Schedule healthy rewards for yourself to benchmark where you've gotten and what you're doing. So if you're trying to lose weight and you're exercising really hard, schedule a massage because you got to this place. Or if you're controlling your spending and you're trying to spend less and making these goals to pay things off, find a way to splurge on like $20 on something good. So it's hard to be self-disciplined. Find healthy ways along the way to reward yourself. And then the last one is this: forgive yourself and move forward. Because here's the truth, it's not always going to go according to plan. You're gonna set goals for yourself and they're noble and they're lofty and they're good and you're gonna go in it and it's gonna feel great. And then you're gonna get to a point where it doesn't, you're gonna have ups and there's downs and you'll mess up. There will be a success and there will be a failure. But the key to it is to keep moving forward. When you have a setback, when you fall off track of where you want to be, acknowledge it. Don't try to act like it doesn't exist. Don't try to like hide it into a closet and pretend it. Acknowledge it. This happened. I did the thing I didn't want to do, or I got off the track of what the goal that I'd made. Acknowledge it, what caused it, what trigger there was, and then move on. And then simply move on. Because it's so easy to get wrapped up in the guilt and the anger and the disappointment and the frustration. But those emotions never help you become more disciplined. Those emotions never set you up for, you know what, let's try again. Instead, they're like, you should have never tried in the first place. It was a bad decision. All right. They don't help you. But what helps is acknowledging that there will be hiccups, that you're not always going to get it perfect, and that's okay. Acknowledge it, forgive yourself, and move on. Get back into the game as quickly as possible. All right, these five things are just methods. They're just ideas to try to help us think about, where do I want to be more self-disciplined? Where do I want to exert more control in my life so that my life is in line with the plan, not the other way around? To live this kind of way, to live, figure out how to do it well, it matters. Instead of just barely making it by or coasting, it matters to figure out how we do this. Now, I mean, I've just never had any aspirations to be an Olympic athlete. I know this shocks you because you look at me and I look like a sprinter or a swimmer or something. I know. Sorry to disappoint you. But no, I mean, I love watching them. I'm so impressed and amazed. But I've never said, man, I want to do that. I want to do the work and the sacrifice that goes into it. If I exercise 2 or 3 times a week, I feel like a champion. If I walk or ride a bike, like I feel like, you know, there should be some type of finish line that I race through. But I admire people who figured out how to push the limits of what their body can do. I am incredibly amazed with people who've said, I don't care that that's the world record, I can beat it. I can do better than that. And they've said no to all of these things so that they could say yes to training their body to do the things that they say matter. And while I have no ambition to train for the Olympics, I do want to figure out how to live my very best life. I do want to figure out how to train myself, my mind and my heart and my body to do the things that we say matters so that I can run this race of life that God's given us the opportunity to be a part of to win. I don't want to lose. I don't want to do all this work and not when I want to win. I want to be on Christ's winning team and organize our life so that I can be the very best girl that God's called me to be. And Paul says, you know, I do this. I discipline myself. Look at the last verse. I don't want to spend all of this time teaching other people and then get disqualified myself. I don't want to spend all this work saying all of these things and then get kicked out of the game. What's interesting is in the 2008 Olympics, the very same race that Usain Bolt, he broke the 200-meter world record. The guy who came in third place was running for America. I mean, he did incredibly well, got the bronze medal. He was running his victory lap, had the American flag around his shoulders. That very same race where he came in third place, he stepped outside the lane. And as you know, in the Olympics, there's very stringent rules about how you get disqualified and what knocks you out of the race if you jump to start. He stepped outside of the lane, and when they reviewed it, they took the medal away from him. They literally, like, he went from victory lap winning a bronze medal to nothing, to not even showing up on the board other than his name with a DQ next to it. Can you imagine how frustrating that would be? Could you imagine just how devastating that guy put all the work in? He put all the effort in. He put the lifetime of training, all of the work, the hours spent getting his body ready, and he stepped outside the lane and he got disqualified, and the medal he thought he won had been taken away. It's just the worst possible case scenario, right? The worst thing that could happen. But Paul wants us to think about life that way. We don't want to put all this energy in, all giving all that we have to grow and discipline ourselves to live our very best life, only to step out of the lane and get disqualified. We don't want to do all this work only to find ourselves at a point where we've lost the vision of where we're supposed to go. We step outside our lane and we get knocked out of the game. We're no longer able to do the work we've been called to do. Could you just imagine how terrible that would be? Vince Lombardi said, winning isn't something. It's not a sometime thing. It's an all the time thing. You don't win once in a while. You don't do things right once in a while. You do them right all of the time. Winning is a habit. But unfortunately, so is losing. What happens is we create the habits of our life based on what we do day after day. We might say, this is the value I aspire to it, but if my daily behaviors don't line up, those aren't values that show up or really actually other than wishful thinking. What happens is our day-to-day actions are the habits that create, are we winning or are we losing? And we either build the kind of habits into our life that help us win, or we're creating the habits, we just settle for the ones that don't. We either strive to do this work that just gives our very, very best, or we give in and accept what is easy. We become what we repeatedly do. That's life. What you do again and again and again, whether you would acknowledge it or not, that's the person you are. That's the person that you've become. And so if we want to take control about this and be intentional about all of this, we got to start practicing the things that lines up with who we want to become. And through practice and discipline and control, we start living out these values that we've aspired to, which means we got to practice gratitude. We got to practice self-awareness. Man, when I am unself-aware, it's obnoxious. Have you been around people who are unself-aware? My daughter plays soccer, and soccer is intense, even at the 7 and 8-year-old level. And there are parents who are on the field screaming and yelling at their children. They're just so, then they start screaming at my child. And it's like, she's 7, back off, you know? But they're so unself-aware, they're just all in into the game. We can practice self-awareness, because guess what? If we don't, nobody's doing it for us. We have to practice that. We can practice prayer and compassion and courage, and we can practice the habits that make us a good spouse and a good parent. We can practice the habits that help us be excellent at the work that we do. We can practice self-discipline, and we can practice grace, and we can practice leadership. Because here's the truth. The world needs men and women who are willing to just step up and be good leaders in this world. Our world needs good leaders. Our world needs men and women who say, it matters that I discipline myself to be a certain kind of person, because when I do, the effect that I get to have on the community around me and the world I'm in, it could be changed for good. Our world needs people who will take this idea of discipline and grace and take it into leadership. And they lead in the kind of way, they practice it, they make a habit of it, they train themselves to be the person they've meant to be. To require something better of themselves, to aspire to something that's a higher standard than just settling for what everyone else is doing. If the church is going to be the hope of the world, we got to produce better leaders. If the church is going to be the hope of the world, then we, us, not somebody else, us, we have to be the kind of leaders that show the grace of God in everything we do. In life, at home, in the workplace, with our friends, on the weekends, with our neighbors, we have to show the grace of God. Look, Christ triumphs in the world when we do that. The church looks like an awesome place to be when the people who are in it are exerting the energy and the effort to train themselves to lead better. Which means we have to show this discipline and this grace as leaders. Because we know the grace of God, we're able to share that grace with others. We're able to share that grace with those around us. And look, the stuff God wants to do in the future, it means new leaders have to step up and say yes to God. It means that new generations have to have new fires burning within them and new challenges that they want to conquer and hills that they want to fight on. And when that happens, more and more and more vision and courage gets stirred up to try new things, to start new causes, to champion in the name of Jesus Christ. We can lead with this grace, and we can lead with this discipline and compassion. We can do it in the world, but you know, we can also do it in the digital world. We can do it on the internet. We can do it on social media, because if we're really honest, that's probably not the most gracious place you've ever been, is it? Sometimes I get so annoyed. Like I have Facebook. I haven't been on Facebook. I can't even tell you how long. Because it just got so annoying. And people were complaining and being mean. And I'm like, you go to church. You should be better than this. You know Christ. You should be more encouraging than this. And I'm sorry, but some of the worst people on Facebook are people who say they're Christians. They're the most mean and the most discouraging and the most, they show the meanest verses about Christ, and like, that's it? Of all the things Christ has done, that's the only thing you can say about him. How would it look if we said, I've disciplined myself to be a gracious person, and I'm going to lead with grace on the internet. I'm going to lead with grace on my social media accounts, so that instead of sharing one more obnoxious story about the end of the world and why all these hurricanes mean the second coming is coming, instead, what if we got to be lights for Christ? What if we got, just by doing life, not preaching 40-minute sermons every day on our internet accounts or in our email or on Facebook, we just got to be kind. And when the conversation's going south and people are commenting and shaming, there is no bigger shameful place than social media. When they're shaming each other, we say something nice. We say something encouraging. Before pressing send on that like super righteous tirade we were going into, we're like, you know, that probably isn't doing Christ any favor. And we don't send it. Like, sometimes that's a win, right? Like, not just saying all of the angry things I want to say. What if we changed the conversation by being gracious, by being kind, by being encouraging? What if we trained ourselves, we disciplined ourselves to be more intentional so that the grace of Jesus Christ showed up in all of the things that we do? I mean, just imagine what God might do with that. Just imagine what people might think about that kind of God, who the people who say they love him the most live graciously. They live kindly and compassionately. I mean, I want to stay in the game. I want to run with all that I have, and I want to win this race instead of just coasting by. I read a really cool book this last week. It's called The Last Arrow by Erwin McManus. If you don't know Erwin McManus, he is the pastor of this just vibrant, thriving church in Hollywood. I can't imagine it's easy to do a church in Hollywood. They've had quite an adventurous story, but Erwin McManus is awesome. If you've never listened to him preach, go on YouTube. He's got a sermon called Battle Ready. It's just, it makes you want to like do something fierce. I don't even know what it is, but something fierce. So this last December, he was actually diagnosed with cancer. He leads several organizations, and they were trying to insure him just in case anything bad ever happened, that the companies and the church would be protected. And he couldn't pass the tests. He couldn't pass the physicals to get the insurance. And he's like this very healthy, very fit, works hard to live a good life. And he's like, that. There's just no way. There's nothing wrong. So for years, this is going on, and there's nothing wrong, but he can't pass these tests. So he finally gets a friend who has a friend who's a doctor. They're like, just could you please sign off on this? Nothing is wrong. Well, this guy finally figures out what's wrong. They did 8 localized biopsies on him, and 5 of the 8 places they tested came back malignant. They said he probably had this cancer for years, and it had metastasized, and it just spiraled out of control. So he had surgery earlier this year to remove the cancer, and you know, he's back at it. He's preaching every week. But what's ironic about it is the year before they found out he had cancer, he was writing this book, The Last Arrow. And the night that he was diagnosed, after telling his wife was with him, telling him they have 2 grown children, he was at home and he was working on the editing. And he picked up the place that he'd left off that he'd been editing in his book. It was like the 4th chapter somewhere. And the line that he started reading is, "Let me tell you before somebody else does, I'm dying. But here's the truth, so are you." And he'd written that a year earlier. He'd written that without knowing any of these diagnoses. And so he said in that moment, listen to what he said, "While cancer might define how I would die, it would not define how I lived." Isn't that amazing? This is his intention for the book. He said that you would never surrender, that you would never settle, that you would save absolutely nothing for the next life. He says, "I don't believe anybody was born average. But I do believe that many of us choose to live lives of mediocrity." He said, "I think there are more of us than not who are in danger of disappearing into the abyss of ordinary." So this is the painful reality. We will find ourselves defined by the average if we do not choose to defy the odds. He said, "You have to refuse to be average." Isn't that a great line? Like, I want to say that to myself again and again and again. We have to refuse to be average, because average is always a safe choice. But he says it's the very most dangerous choice that you could ever make, because being average protects you from the risk of failure, but it also separates you from futures of greatness. And then this is what he says. He says, "I wonder how many victories are lost before the battle has ever begun. I wonder how much more good God desires to usher into the world that's been thwarted by our own lack of ambition." He said, "I wonder how many times in my own life I thought I failed, but actually the only thing that happened was I quit." He said, "We stop before God is finished." He said, "If one day we have a conversation with God about the measure of our lives, I'd rather have him ask me why I tried to do much than have him ask me why I settled for so little." Here's the truth. This is our life. This is our shot. This is our time. We don't get warm-up runs, right? Like, we don't get a trial shot at doing it 2 or 3 times. This is it. This is our life. And his whole point is, what are we waiting for? What in the world are we waiting for to happen before we give all that we have to give? He says, "Why are you saving any of those arrows? You can't take them with you. They don't go with you into the next life. Why not shoot every single one you can right now? Why not give everything that you have and save nothing for the next life? What are you waiting for?" Here's the truth. every one of us just has a set number of days to live, and we don't get to pick. We don't get to choose. We don't know how many we have. We do know we get to decide how we are going to live. We get to determine how we use the gift God's given us and the life that we use. And what if God's just looking right now for people to bless? What if, as the scriptures tell us, God's looking throughout the whole earth to bless and to call the people whose hearts are turned towards him? What if right now the hardest problem that God wants to tackle in the world, he's just waiting for a spirit that says, I'm in. I won't settle. I won't quit. I won't give up. I won't settle for less than anything better than what you want to do. What if God's just waiting for us, for you and for I, to say yes to him? What if the next adventure, the next awesome thing that's going to take place in our world happens because you determine to run the race in the kind of way that you might win? And you say, God, I'm in. Pick me. Choose me. Call me. Let's go. Let's get this awesome work done that the name of Christ might be glorified in our generation. Dear Heavenly Father, I pray that you would be with us. I pray, Father, that you would help us to determine to win this race of life. I pray that you would help us to just stop making excuses, to stop waiting for anything to happen, but that we would pick up the mantle, that we would step up to the plate. Father, we would toe the line and we would kick off with all the energy and the courage you've given us to have. I pray, Father, that we would do life in the kind of way that we lead graciously, that we discipline ourselves ruthlessly, Father, that our lives might be better because of it. I pray, Father, that the lives we live, that the choices we make would just reflect the grace of Jesus Christ into this world. I pray, Father, that you would choose us, that as you look to and fro throughout the whole earth, Father, you would look down on us here in Old Brooklyn today, that you would pour out a double measure of grace on our hearts, that we might be your champions in the world, doing your good work. And I pray this all in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thank you for listening. If you would like more information about Christ Church, check us out on the web at christchurchohio.org. If we can be of any help to you, call us at 440-236-8282. Until next time, blessings to you.